The state's largest school district has plans to start the year online and could extend that a little more. Our interview today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Houston ISD's interim superintendent joins us to talk about the weight of planning this school year. We'll also hear from teachers who are frankly afraid for themselves and their families, but also love being in the classroom. A Texas law expert joins us to parse out exactly what's going on with federal agents arresting people in Portland, and a harrowing story about COVID-19 and Texas ICE detention centers. That and more just ahead on The Standard. You've got it tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. It's Wednesday, July 22nd, and we're now starting to get a better idea of exactly what the return to school will look like for students of all ages across Texas. The bottom line, of course, it's going to look different. I'm not much of a meme person. I don't share them on social media or even like them all that much most of the time. But there was one someone posted in a mom's group I'm in this week that seemed to exactly capture the moment for many. It was Kristen Wiig's face, frozen three times in a row in disgust and disbelief from a skit on Saturday Night Live. Under the first one said, starting school in person. The second one was, starting school online. The third, homeschooling. The headline on top was, every parent's face right now. But you could also sub that in for every teacher, maybe every superintendent, every student. Of course, there are folks who've been homeschooling for years now with no problem, for example. But if there were ever a one-size-fits-all solution for schooling, there certainly isn't now. Granita Lathan is feeling that pressure. She's interim superintendent for the largest public school system in Texas, Houston ISD. Superintendent Lathan, thanks for your time.
Good morning. Thank you for having me today.
If you could tell us briefly, what is Houston ISD's plan for school this fall?
Our plan for to open the 2020-21 school year is to operate virtually for the first 6 weeks of the school year and then transition students back face-to-face. But parents will also have the option to choose remote learning for the semester or for the entire school year.
So how did this decision come about? I imagine not quickly or easily.
It was not easy to make the decision to be 100% virtual. But in Harris County and the city of Houston, due to the rising number and the high number of positive cases, you know, you're talking about over 20% positive COVID-19 cases, and just where we are as a community right now, that wasn't the top reason. The second and kind of third, and they actually share the same space, were surveys that we conducted with our parents and our teachers on their comfort level of returning back to face-to-face instruction. We only had 18% of 7,000 teachers, 7,600 teachers that participated in the survey that felt comfortable returning. The numbers for parents were just a little bit more balanced, but I believe it was about 56% that were not comfortable returning. And so all of that was taken into consideration in making the decision to be 100% virtual the first 6 weeks of school.
Now, I'm glad you brought up the cases in Harris County, because I understand Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo just this week recommended that area school districts extend online instruction a little further than you have, at 6 weeks to 8 weeks, something the Texas Education Agency will now allow if school boards approve it. Would you consider extending that window?
Yes, and like I said, that played a factor into knowing that, like I said, we're going to go 6 weeks. We now really have up to 8 weeks, and if we need those 8 weeks, we definitely would put a resolution in front of our school board for approval.
So the end of last school year was really difficult for parents, for teachers, for, you know, school districts, for students. What has Houston learned, and how have you been preparing for another period of online instruction?
I'll tell you the first thing that we've learned, and we actually knew it. We knew it back in 2017 when we experienced Harvey as a city and as a school district, that we have some outstanding members of Team HISD and outstanding members in our community, because we were able to turn on a dime and move from face-to-face instruction to virtual instruction immediately. Lessons learned are that we do need some better systems in place when you think about remote learning. And we've developed an instructional continuity plan that will guide teachers and parents and principals through the virtual process. We've selected various platforms that will be able to assist teachers with their live instruction. We are also, we've created a class for parents so that they understand what virtual learning is and how they can assist their child during the time that we are learning virtually.
You know, there's been a lot of discussion about families who don't necessarily have the same access to internet or to, you know, equipment. What difficulties are there, and how are you trying to bridge them?
Well, our goal is to ensure that all of our elementary and middle school students have their own device. We have a program in our high schools called Power Up. And so all 50,000 students, high school students, they have their own device. And so another lesson learned was we needed to be prepared to have devices, like I said, at the elementary and middle school levels. And we've been working to ensure that every child that needs a laptop, Chromebook, or iPad and a hotspot, that they have them when we open on September 8th. And so we're still working on that, just like other school districts across the country. And in our state, we're waiting for our shipments to arrive.
I just wonder, I mean, the weight of a superintendent is always big. But I wonder if this feels like an especially difficult time because the decisions that you make could, you know, worst case scenario, involve people's lives and their deaths. I just wonder how you're feeling with that, you know, personally right now.
I mean, and you're right. That is amazing. Like I said, the job is difficult in itself, and then when you add a pandemic in the midst of it, it does make it difficult. And that's another decision that, you know, it weighs on me heavily as I make decisions about reopening or virtual, is not wanting to put any staff member nor student in harm's way. And so it weighs heavily as we look at the statistics as it relates to the positive cases and also the number of deaths that have occurred in our community.
We've been speaking with Granita Lathan. She is interim superintendent for the Houston Independent School District. Superintendent Lathan, thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care.
Though Houston has a tentative school plan, a lot of other districts across the state are still deciding whether to start with in-person or with online classes this fall. That's because, as I mentioned briefly, the state's education commissioner reconsidered the agency's edict that all schools start with in-person classes next month. But with so much still undecided in many places, many teachers are worried. In North Texas, KERA talked with some educators who feel stuck between a deadly virus and the passion to teach in person.
Education Commissioner Mike Morath's policy shift was like a bright light for some teachers, including Sarah Johnson. Despite doubting students can stay 6 feet apart from each other or wear masks all day, the veteran Dallas School District teacher welcomed the guidance of doctors.
Because it means that as soon as the medical communities in our area say that we're good, then we're able to start again. But it also doesn't try to pressure the school to fit into a date that doesn't actually reflect the reality of what the virus is doing in their area.
Erica Cole, a teacher in Denton, was more skeptical of the commissioner's announcement.
It was a way to push off the responsibility onto others.
Cole's district has moved the first day of school to August 26th, and is still surveying parents about teaching online or in person. Like every teacher interviewed, Cole prefers face-to-face instruction. She and her husband both have underlying health conditions and are raising their 3-year-old daughter.
I love my job. For me, going to school, fine arts was the reason why I went. For many students, they feel the same way. There is a teacher, there is someone special to them in that school, and that's why they go. But I shouldn't have to choose between taking care of my family and taking care of my students.
Cole's family extends beyond those at home, including an adult son battling drug addiction.
One of the things that I worry about is that if I get sick, will he be able to handle the stress or if I die, will that cause him to start using again?
One lesson that elementary school teacher Esther Martinez says will be central to this year's curriculum: hygiene and keeping a safe distance. She's just not sure how effective those lessons will be with a class of 20 to 25 students.
If we are required to keep our kids socially distant, that means that when I'm traveling in the hallway, my line is going to be like 75 feet long. I don't know how I can keep my eyes on all of my kids if they're that spread out.
Denton teacher Shashinka Lopez says preaching hand hygiene doesn't always work.
You know, we already teach young children the importance of washing their hands and covering their mouths and their elbows when they sneeze and they cough. And we still have massive illness through the school during the flu season, for example.
In this season of the coronavirus, Dallas Advanced Placement Spanish instructor Delna Bryan worries the disease will inevitably spread, even with precautions like checking a child's temperature before boarding the bus and again before walking into school.
But what happens if that child, by lunchtime, there's an elevated temperature, they want to send that child home? Where do you find a parent at that time when most parents are at work? Is that safe? I don't think it's safe.
In this sea of concern, filled with COVID-19 icebergs, Bryan worries procedures in place that allow face-to-face instruction won't be enough to navigate around trouble. I'm Bill Zeebel in Dallas.
Time now to check in on the Talk of Texas with social media editor Wells Dunbar. Wells, how are you?
Good, Laura. Discussion about schools and the issues inherent in reopening them continuing to dominate talk online among our friends and listeners. On our Facebook page, Dale Corbett writes about a teacher he knows that went into the classroom the other day, moved the desks apart, and was only able to fit in 15, and they were still only 3 feet apart. Meanwhile, Janice Hitchcock says this about the enterprise to reopen schools. Let's be real, she writes. The people who are pushing for schools to reopen are the same people who have been systematically underfunding and dismantling our education system. You know, school reopening also a topic in this week's Texas Standard newsletter, which just went out as it does every Wednesday. In case folks haven't signed up for our weekly dispatch, including behind-the-scenes content with reporters from across Texas, I'd remind them that they can do so at texasstandard.org. Those school reopenings, just one story we're keeping an eye on, Laura. I'll be back with more stories and reactions from social media later in the show.
All right, thank you, Wells. And we'd like to know what you think. You can find us on Twitter or on Facebook or email texasstandard@kut.org. We'll see you in a few.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, offering annual preventative and screening appointments with safety protocols in place. Early detection is critical to better cancer outcomes. More at texasoncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
You've got it tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. As protests against police violence approach their second month in Portland, Oregon, a disturbing sight has become commonplace. Unidentified federal agents clad in camouflage and operating out of unmarked vans detaining protesters. Images of the arrests have gone viral, and a lot of people are wondering what exactly is going on. One of those people is Steve Vladek. He's a constitutional law scholar and professor at the University of Texas School of Law. He recently posed 6 questions concerning the situation in Portland on the Lawfare blog. Steve, it's good to have you back on the Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Let's explore the questions you posed on Lawfare one by one. First, we know Customs and Border Protection is one federal agency involved, and actually it's one of the more clear-cut cases because Portland is less than 100 miles from the coast, considered part of CBP's zone. But do we know which other agencies' officers are being utilized for federal law enforcement purposes in Portland and under what statutory authorities?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the real hook that the federal government's relying on is the destruction, the vandalism, the damage to federal property. And that's primarily the purview of a law enforcement agency called the Federal Protective Service. But there's a statute from 2002, part of the Homeland Security Act, that was enacted after 9/11, that gives the acting Secretary of Homeland Security the power to use any other DHS officers, basically to backstop the Federal Protective Service. And so it sounds like that's what's going on, that the federal property is the hook, the Federal Protective Service is the primary agency, and then CBP, not just because of the 100 miles from the coast, but also just as a general proposition, is backstopping the Federal Protective Service under this 2002 law.
That's interesting. That leads us right into your second question, which is what federal laws are these officers enforcing? So you're saying they don't necessarily have to be arresting people just for this vandalism. That's just the way in.
That's right. And I think it's pretty important to note that there are a wide array of federal crimes out there. Those don't all pertain to federal property. There are a bunch of federal drug crimes, mail fraud, wire fraud, you know, things of that ilk. The tricky part is that at least some of the reports out of Portland suggest that there are arrests of protesters unrelated to federal crimes. And this is where I think the law is quite clear. Federal law enforcement officers don't generally have the authority to arrest for local and state crimes. That is to say, their job is to enforce federal law, not to enforce all law. And so restoring order in a protest, that's the job of the Portland and Oregon police. It's not the job of federal law enforcement. That's where I think there are serious questions about what the federal government has been up to in Portland.
And that is your third question, which is, what authorities do these federal officers have to detain and arrest individuals? What answers are we getting about that right now?
So the only answers that we're getting from CBP are that they're detaining and arresting people for violations of federal statutes, the ones about vandalism and damage to federal property. A lot of discussion from Acting Secretary Wolf and from Ken Cuccinelli about the Hatfield Courthouse, which is a federal courthouse in Portland. But what's really weird, Laura, is we haven't seen reports of indictments for those arrests. That is to say, if this were true, if that story is what was actually happening, we'd expect to see charges. That's where I think there's a real concern that these authorities might be being abused.
Now, I want to skip around just a minute because you mentioned Acting Secretary Wolf, and that's the Department of Homeland Security Acting Secretary Chad Wolf. It seems that they are in charge, and that's one question that you have here. Why is that the department that's taking the lead?
That's right. I mean, I think this is a real sort of question about both the legal authorities and the politics. I mean, usually we think of the Justice Department as having primary responsibility for law enforcement. I think what government's capitalizing upon, Laura, is a real shift in authorities after 9/11, where the new Department of Homeland Security was given a whole bunch of law enforcement responsibilities that had historically been the purview of the Justice Department. And I think, you know, that is something that the White House is capitalizing upon, because these agencies, CBP, ICE, et cetera, the senior leadership at DHS, I think they believe to be more malleable and perhaps more willing to push the boundaries of what's lawful. You know, CBP is not designed for this task. The officers are not trained for counter-protest maneuvering. They're not trained for this kind of show of force. And I think, you know, there's a real question to be asked about why, of every law enforcement agency in the federal arsenal, you know, the president, the White House, the acting secretary pick this one. I don't think it's because they're especially effective.
The last question you posed is perhaps the most important, which is, how are we going to learn answers to any of these questions?
Yeah, so I think there are two tracks. I mean, I think there's already litigation pending in Oregon, three different lawsuits about whether these arrests are legal, whether these deployments are legal. But I also think, you know, a lot of this is going to fall on Congress, especially as, you know, we see more and more claims that we're going to see deployments like this in other American cities, Chicago, the president mentioned Baltimore. You know, I think this is a real area where Congress could do some yeoman work. You know, just this week, the House of Representatives is taking up DHS appropriations for next year. I have to think that the House is going to be a little wary about appropriating funds for some of the activities we've been seeing over the last week.
Steve Vladek is a professor at the University of Texas School of Law and a contributor to Lawfare. We'll get a link up to his article at texasstandard.org. Professor Vladek, thanks again.
Thank you, Laura.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Along with video games and booze, seeds for gardening are sold out at many stores nationwide and in Texas. That's because, as we told you a while back, the pandemic has a lot of Texans discovering or rediscovering the joys of gardening. But 100-degree days have scorched thirsty plants and left growers wondering what to do now. Sarah Self-Walbrick has more from Lubbock.
Jennifer Villegas planted her first garden at the beginning of the pandemic. She really dug in.
This was a bid for me to retain a little bit of sanity.
Three people in her home are high risk for catching COVID-19, so the family is taking social distancing seriously. But between nonstop social media and news, Villegas needs a break.
If the news has me down, I go get in the dirt. Kids are on my nerves, go get in the dirt. You know, if I'm sad because I'm, you know, sick of these four walls, go get in the dirt. And there's blue sky and there's fresh air.
Planting seeds, pulling weeds, watering. Villegas says it's all cathartic in a time when she feels like she has very little control. Then summer came. Lubbock experienced a record heat wave this month. Temperatures climbed to over 100 degrees for 11 days in a row, tying for the second longest streak in the city's history. The National Weather Service in Lubbock reports temperatures peaked on July 14th at 111 degrees. The streak broke on Sunday when it was only 96.
Squash were the first to go, and I even had a little squash, a little baby squash, cricket squash growing. So I was so sad when those plants left me.
Vikram Baliga, a horticulturist at Texas Tech, has gotten a lot of questions as people have picked up gardening and landscaping to pass the many hours spent at home during the pandemic.
Are all my plants on fire? Why is everything dead?
Joking aside, Baliga advises amateur gardeners to start small. Pick a project that can be done in an afternoon. On the dry and hot South Plains, Baliga says peppers and squash usually fruit well. He says to water thoroughly, soaking the soil. Vegetables probably need to be watered daily, other plants less frequently. Pick a place where plants will get morning sun and afternoon shade. Now's the time to get fall plants ready. Baliga says start seeds inside now, transfer them outside by the end of August, and enjoy the fruits of labor.
And then, you know, you get all of September and usually pretty much all of October where your plants will fruit. You know, in general, we're not going to see a freeze until we're into November.
Villegas is optimistic and will try again when the temperatures cool to the 70s and 80s typical for a Lubbock fall.
Okay, I've got this really great soil that I've started.
In Lubbock, I'm Sarah Self-Walbrick.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. U.S. officials have ordered China to close its consulate in Houston by Friday. As Houston Public Media's Davis Land reports, fires were seen at the building shortly after Tuesday's announcement.
Firefighters were reportedly barred from entering the building, where Houston police say smoke was seen and bystander video shows people who appear to be burning paper in trash cans in the consulate's courtyard. The consulate is one of five in the U.S. alongside the embassy in Washington, D.C. The State Department says the move to close it is, quote, to protect American intellectual property and Americans' private information. The department did not offer any details on why the Houston consulate was chosen specifically. China has condemned the move and warned of what a spokesperson called firm countermeasures if the decision is not reversed. I'm Davis Land in Houston.
Former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke says Republican Governor Greg Abbott is choosing to let more people die from COVID-19 than necessary instead of allowing stricter measures to fight the pandemic. The El Paso Democrat said on MSNBC last night the Texas GOP is okay with the rising death toll because wealthier white residents are disproportionately less affected by the virus.
It'll be African Americans, it'll be Latinos and Mexican Americans who will be doing the dying right here in Texas. This is a death cult, the Texas GOP, only they want you to do the dying. And that's exactly what is happening in Texas right now.
O'Rourke, who ended his bid for president last fall, said the governor needs to give mayors and county judges the power to enforce local stay-at-home orders. Meanwhile, officials in the Rio Grande Valley are issuing stay-at-home orders to try to reduce the spread of the coronavirus in the region as the number of new infections continue surging and hospitals are overwhelmed. A new curfew and measure mandating people shelter in their residences took effect in Hidalgo County today. Leaders in neighboring Starr County plan to issue a measure requiring people to stay at home by the end of the week. County Judge Eloy Vera said Tuesday that while he does not have the authority to enforce the order, it's vital people comply.
And hopefully our citizens will understand the seriousness as to why we're doing this.
Governor Abbott allowed local governments to enforce stay-at-home orders at the beginning of the pandemic, but has since refused to give them the authority again. And the number of women testing positive for COVID-19 at a federal medical prison in Texas has more than doubled in the past few days. The Federal Medical Center Carswell in Fort Worth has 510 confirmed cases. That's according to figures the Bureau of Prisons released yesterday. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the online UT High School, offering a full-time diploma program and a variety of individual courses, including for advanced placement. Learn more about options for the new school year at highschool.utexas.edu.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. One of the sectors that's hit hardest by the COVID-19 pandemic is the airline industry. Even as activity perks up a little, the number of passengers and flights at Austin Bergstrom International Airport are a fraction of what they were this time last year. KUT's Samuel King has more on the turbulence the pandemic is causing.
If you haven't been to the airport in a while, you'll find that some sights are familiar. Passengers rushing to beat final check-in or boarding calls. But other sights are different. Masks are everywhere, and there's a lot more hand sanitizer and cleaning crews. It's something passenger Michael Lynn from Richmond, Virginia has noticed.
They've actually been pretty good about how they handle the separation of the seats, the cleanliness. I feel comfortable.
The same for Teresa Prince, who is heading back to Michigan after visiting her son.
No, I'm not worried about traveling, but it's what it is.
But a lot of people are still reluctant to fly. Mandy McClendon is Communications and Marketing Manager for Austin Bergstrom International Airport.
So right now, we're averaging around about 5,000 outbound passengers each day. On a typical day this time of year, we would usually see around 30,000 outbound passengers.
The traffic decline is impacting the airport financially. It's already had to cut $20 million from its budget this fiscal year. And city manager Spencer Kronk projects revenue for the airport will drop 30% in the upcoming fiscal year. McClendon says fewer travelers at the airport has a ripple effect.
And so, of course, our revenue sources are aeronautical and non-aeronautical. And both of those depend on how many passengers are traveling through our terminal. So that's not only flights, it's also, you know, parking and concessions.
So the slowdown is also impacting people who work at the airport. Unite Here is the union that represents more than 300,000 concessions and hospitality workers across the country. It says almost 96% of its membership at Austin Bergstrom was laid off at one point. Union member Guadalupe Garcia works as a cashier at the airport.
We were already thinking that we're all going to be laid off.
Seniority meant she got to hold on to her job, but as more employees have come back to work, her hours have been cut.
When we started, we were still getting our 40 hours in the beginning. Now it went down to 30. Now I'm down to 28. I'm getting 28 hours a week right now.
Garcia says she doesn't mind, as it keeps her colleagues employed as well. The city council directed the airport to work with concession companies to find ways to preserve jobs. The $58 million in CARES Act funding the airport received can only be used for operating expenses and paying down debt, but the airport has found other solutions. Concessions fees for those companies have been suspended at least through September, providing millions of dollars in relief. The airport is waiving administrative costs for security badges once furloughed employees are rehired. The airport is also exploring how to expand technology that could allow customers to pay for food or retail items through an app and have that delivered to a passenger wherever they are in the airport. Airport leaders say that could help preserve jobs, but Unite Here's Bo Delp says the union wants to make sure workers aren't left behind.
As we explore potential uses of technology, we have to ensure that this technology does not lead to further displacement of airport workers. We have to ensure, and the city must ensure, that as it moves forward with keeping passengers and workers safe, that it is doing so in a way that actually leads to additional jobs.
Uncertainty remains about the aviation industry in the coming months. Some airlines have warned of massive layoffs when CARES Act funding provisions end later this year. But analyst Mike Boyd is optimistic that domestic travel could mostly rebound in Austin by the end of the year. In the meantime, he says airports are still at the mercy of decisions by airlines.
It's very difficult for an airport to plan when the schedule that's published by an airline today might not be there 2 weeks from now, or what they show today is half of what they're going to have 2 weeks from now. It's going to be it's a balancing game.
Flights to Mexico have resumed at Austin Bergstrom, but flights to Europe are suspended indefinitely. Those flights had been part of the airport's ambitious expansion plans that included a project to double the size of the airport by adding another terminal, which is now on hold. McClendon says even though it may take a few years for traffic to return to where it was in 2019, the 2040 master plan remains in place.
We are confident that Central Texans passengers will want to travel again, and we'll be there and ready to serve them when that happens. And so even if we don't rebound quickly, we know that we will. And at that time, when that happens, we will be ready to move forward with those plans.
So airport leaders are hoping for clear skies after an unknown period of turbulence.
KUT Austin's Samuel King reporting.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town while keeping safety in mind. Shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions like Moody Gardens and more. Details at galveston.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle.
Hello, this is Rosie Davila, and I'd like to introduce my parents, Eliseo and Maria Davila. They have been blessed with a marriage of 75 years.
There was a man in our town who had a kiosk on the main plaza. The town is called Monte Morelos in Nuevo León, Mexico. He sold fresh drinks and ice cream, and he had a radio. It was during World War II when we met on that plaza.
I was 19, so young. He was young too. We are the same age.
The tradition was that every evening all the bachelor men would walk around the town square, say clockwise, and all the single ladies would walk counterclockwise, and we would lock eyes with the person we liked. But that was it. You would just look at them every time they walked by. And I liked everything about her, the way she carried herself, the way she looked.
I cannot say I was beautiful. He was handsome, but I wouldn't say I was.
I would tell everyone, she has to be my wife. She has to be my wife. Mayo 19th, 1945. God answered my prayer. She is my wife.
We were very happy. Never thought about going our separate ways. He was always working. I took care of the kids. We had 11. One died, but he still counts, right? And we were very happy because we had the love of God, and we attended church together, and reared the kids to be righteous people. We are old now, but we still love each other like we did back then. We love our children very much, and they love us.
Bueno, primeramente, la bendición de Dios.
I think the first thing that happened is that we had God's blessing. And you have to have faith for a marriage to succeed and trust in the Lord.
Many times when we make mistakes, we feel like giving up. No! Learn to forgive. Learn to keep going. Learn to love each other like you did the first day.
I think my loving God blessed me too much.
My old man. He's not even wrinkled. He is very handsome and loving. There's no one like him.
I'm Rosie Davila from Corpus Christi, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Laura Rice. The coronavirus is making people sick all across the state, but if you're in a Texas immigrant detention center, you're 15 times more likely to have COVID-19. That's according to Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the Texas Department of State Health Services. Despite high infection rates, Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Trovall found ICE detention officials are failing to provide adequate social distancing and medical care. Her story is based on nearly 30 interviews with detainees.
I met up with Israel Rodriguez at a park just moments after he was released from the Joe Corley ICE facility north of Houston. He's 31 years old and wears a white t-shirt and the typical blue disposable medical mask. He describes the medical care he saw inside.
I had a friend from Burma, and he was a pretty good guy. And he was in bed for 4 days and couldn't get out of bed. And he was coughing, he had a fever and chills. And, he presented all the symptoms that the health experts talked about. But yeah, so he wasn't tested.
Rodriguez himself ran a low-grade fever and asked for testing. He was denied. He asked again soon before he was going to be released because he was planning to see his dad, who has cancer. The nurse wouldn't let him.
Specifically told me that no, that ICE had told him that they should not test us. That they should refrain from doing so, and that it should only be done so in the most severe or, a dramatic of cases. But as general testing or widespread testing, they said that that was not to happen.
A mí en particular me lo negaron y no hacen prueba.
That's Roger Ernesto Lao Muñoz. He's still inside that same facility, and he says he couldn't get tested either. He's from Cuba and studied hygiene and epidemiology. He told me the only time he saw people getting tested was when there were large clusters of cases or when people were about to be deported. At an ICE facility in El Paso, one detainee says she wasn't tested until she was bedridden. ICE says they've ramped up testing, and its numbers show that more than a quarter of detainees test positive. The test positive rate for the general population is 16% in Texas. At the Montgomery Processing Center north of Houston, more than 200 people have tested positive, plus 22 staff. And if somebody gets sick, they don't do anything for us. One detainee there says they don't even give us pills for headaches. We're not using the detainee's name to avoid possible retaliation. He says staff did test people in his 30-person dorm room. As people tested positive, guards would shuffle them into another room in groups.
No puedo respirar bien, como que me canso más.
He says even though he's recovered, he still can't breathe well and gets tired faster. ICE says it's taken precautions to slow the spread. It's given multiple masks to each detainee, and it's released more than half of the detained population in Texas. In a statement, ICE said it complies with CDC testing guidelines, adding that detainees with COVID-19 symptoms are checked out by a medical professional who decides whether or not to test them. ICE also says it offers voluntary testing at some facilities. But for those still inside, social distancing seems to be impossible. One woman in the El Paso facility who asked to remain anonymous recalled guards' orders.
They just made us rotate our heads. Like the person that was on top would have their head on the neck, and then the girl on the bottom would have her head on the right. That was the social distancing.
Julie Posh is an immigration lawyer in Houston and says the public needs to put more pressure on ICE to release everyone they can.
The single most important thing they need to be doing is releasing people. That is the best way to stop the spread of this virus in the detention centers, is to get people out of the detention centers so they can quarantine at home with their families, with relatives, with whoever they may be able to live with.
She says most of the people inside these facilities don't have serious criminal records. And even though ICE has released thousands of detainees, in Texas, more than 5,000 people are still in immigration lockup. They're among the most vulnerable in the state to the disease. I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. U.S. Senator John Cornyn of Texas says, quote, "No one under the age of 20 has died of the coronavirus. We still don't know whether children can get it and transmit it to others," close quote. But is that a fact? Madeline Meckelberg of PolitiFact Texas at the Austin American Statesman spoke with Texas Standard host David Brown to parse out fact and falsehood.
So when did Senator Cornyn say this about coronavirus and people under the age of 20?
The senator said this during an interview he did with a television station in Dallas right after the Texas Education Agency announced its first set of guidelines for opening schools this fall. Mm-hmm. And we know those guidelines have since changed to allow a little bit more flexibility at the start of the school year for online instruction. Right. But at this point in time, he was talking about how when they're making these decisions, the most important factor needs to be safety.
No one under the age of 20 has died of the coronavirus. We still don't know whether children can get it and transmit it to others.
Well, it sounds like we have a couple of things to unpack. What about that first part, that no one under the age of 20 has died of the coronavirus?
First of all, it's important to say that people of any age can contract the coronavirus, and they have. The issue here is the risk of serious illness increases with age, but people under the age of 20 actually have died after contracting the virus. Looking nationally, there's been about 29 people under the age of 14 and 142 people between the ages of 15 and 24 who have died after contracting the virus. But in Texas, it's a little bit harder to track those numbers because we only know demographic information like age after the state has investigated a coronavirus fatality. And at the time Cornyn said this, the state had investigated just 700 of the about 3,000 fatalities reported, and none of those were people under the age of 20. But we've heard from local health authorities that they have anecdotal evidence of people under the age of 20 who have died. For example, in April, a 17-year-old girl in Lancaster died after contracting the virus. Mm-hmm. And actually, the same day Cornyn gave this interview, there was an infant in Corpus Christi who reportedly died after contracting the virus.
So when you talk about that anecdotal evidence of deaths, you're talking about in Texas, and you're specifically referring to the lack of hard data relative to, say, what we're hearing at the national level.
That's exactly right. And it's not because those deaths don't exist in the official data. It's just because they haven't reviewed those cases to be able to extract that demographic information just yet.
Well, I think that a lot of listeners have probably heard that children can get the coronavirus, but there has been some question about whether or not they can transmit it. Now, Senator Cornyn suggested we don't quite know that yet.
Senator Cornyn's staff has said that during this interview, he was not actually suggesting that we don't know if children can get the virus, but he was saying we don't know if they can get it and transmit it. So the emphasis being on whether or not they can transmit it, although people certainly read this to be that he was saying we don't know if children can get it. So just keep that context in mind.
All right.
But on the transmission question, the research that we have right now suggests that children are not contracting the virus at the same rate as adults and are less prone to disease and infections. And it suggests that children are capable of spreading the virus, but what's understudied here is the extent to which they can actually transmit it. So We know based on the data, it seems right now that children are not driving the transmission of this virus. They're not why we're seeing such widespread infection rates. But that doesn't mean that they can't transmit the virus. You know, there have been studies done, one in China, one in Germany, that have shown that children can transmit the virus, even if they may be less likely to do so than adults.
Sounds like you might be prepared to issue a rating.
So we rated this claim false.
False. Senator John Cornyn's claim that no one under the age of 20 has died of the coronavirus and that we still don't know whether children can get it and transmit it to others. Yes, children under the age of 20 have in fact died of the coronavirus, and we do know that children can get it and transmit it to others. But Madeline, as you say, it's not the main mode of transmission, at least according to health officials right now.
That's exactly right.
Madeline Meckelberg is with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American-Statesman. Madeline, we'll see you next week.
I'm looking forward to it.
And you are listening
to the Texas Standard. And it is time once again to check in with social media host Wells Dunbar. Wells, what are you seeing out there?
Hey, Laura. Well, President Trump released a memo Tuesday that calls for a vast change to the constitutionally mandated census count of every person living in the United States. The memo calls to exclude unauthorized immigrants from those numbers that we use to divvy up seats in Congress among the states. Again, let's emphasize that this is something the president cannot do himself. Congress sees to the census and the vast amount of political and financial influence it wields for the states. But that said, Texas, should this change come to transpire, Texas would be on the receiving end of a huge change here. It could stand to lose big if in terms of money and congressional apportionment. Here's some of the things we're hearing from our friends and listeners out there via Facebook. Francisca Harris says, whether a citizen or not, every person who lives in a community impacts things like road usage, schools, healthcare, and more. She calls it a last-ditch effort to try and get control, Republican control of the House back. And Craig Anders York, also via Facebook, says Texas would lose big in more ways than one. While this year's census is already a mess, I doubt this would have much impact past the headlines. He goes on to note that this would be challenged in the courts, and while he has no doubt that the White House would try and push it to the Supreme Court, there will not be time for that before the election, he writes. Also seeing lots of speculation out there, Laura, that it could be essentially a distraction from the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, which I believe has topped 140,000 deaths here domestically in the official counts we're seeing there, Laura. So lots to mull over there.
And just the efforts to complete that that census in the first place. A lot of households still haven't filled them out and gotten them back, and this could continue to cause concern and confusion.
Definitely so. Well, speaking of concern and confusion, hearing from several people about that interview we had earlier in the show, the use of unidentified federal police to detain protesters in Portland. Here are some of the remarks we're seeing. This one here from John Nielsen, who says via Facebook, he's writing from the viewpoint of a retired police officer. He goes on to say that we were proud of our uniform, our badge number, and our name tag, all clearly visible to the public. We felt that in our duties, we had nothing to hide from anyone, and we would be held accountable for our actions. He adds that to strip that away and replace it with anonymity would be against all of our training, and he condemns it as a tactic to license misconduct. Interesting remark there. And also continuing to hear about the ongoing bid to reopen Texas schools, you know, less than a month to go now, Laura. I don't have to tell you, parent to parent, we got a lot of concerns and issues here. This tweet from Helen Bird, she writes us that as a pediatric nurse, I feel it's unsafe to reopen schools, especially with flu season on the horizon.
Well, we're interested to hear what our listeners think. They can find us on social media. See you back here tomorrow.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.